The Tom Woods Show, episode 2254.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody, we all know it is time for us to break up, but everybody's status quo bias is standing in the way of this obvious and humane solution. Check out my brand new ebook called National Divorce, The Peaceful Solution to Irreconcilable Differences, which you can get for free at nationaldivorce.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. I'm delighted to be joined once again by our friend Derek Brose, who now has a second edition of his important book, How to Opt Out of the Technocratic State. And of course, given what's gone on in the world over the past few years, you can understand why you would want to go back and amplify some points and point to where things you predicted came true faster than any of us may have expected. So, Derek, welcome back.
Thank you for having me on, Tom. Appreciate you.
All right. First of all, we have to talk a little bit about the extra material in the book since the last time we spoke. But just set the stage here for us. When we say the technocratic state, what are we talking about here? And why should we fear it? Why is it not made up of decent people who just want what's best for society?
Well, so I appreciate the opportunity to explain that term, technocratic state, because when I was coming up with the title for this book back in late 2019, it was originally published January 31st, 2020, so right before COVID, I was taking some of my own research as a journalist, studying facial recognition, obviously social credit scores in China, digital IDs in India, places like that, and was also paying attention to various digital rights groups, lawyers fighting for digital privacy who've been warning for years now that we are, well, we're already, I think, in it, but they were warning years ago that we're moving very quickly into a space with AI and facial recognition that would be very dangerous for privacy, for individual liberty, and that once we move into that space, it might be very difficult to just put Pandora's box back, you know, back together, so to speak, and put it all away and imagine that these tools will not be used by tyrants. And so it was kind of originally coming from that standpoint. And obviously your audience is familiar with the idea of the state itself and the inherent problems with government. And I started to take that concept of just the state, but what does the state look like once it's empowered with unlimited AI, artificial intelligence tools, where it has endless amounts of data to use to analyze and study its citizens, to use against them in terms of social credit score and all these kinds of ideas. And so that's where that term comes from, but it's also because the first part of the book, for those who haven't read it yet, is a very short summary kind of study of the philosophy of technocracy, which goes back to the mid to late 1800s in its earliest forms, but really got popular around the Depression. And just like democracy is allegedly the rule of the people, this is a technocracy which would be ruled by technocrats or the experts, which is obviously something we've heard a lot the last couple of years. Listen to the experts, trust the experts. So it's the idea that humanity, individuals are too stupid to rule themselves and democracy doesn't work and monarchy is flawed. So instead we should have rule by technocrats, by the experts using their tools in this case to micromanage, centrally plan society. And so that's kind of how I envision not only the age-old problems of state itself, but that now combined with this technocratic philosophy and digital tools that we've never seen before.
And I think one ingredient of this is by means of the state schools is to, in a way, sometimes indirectly, but one way or another, try to persuade some of the public of the overall goodness of the regime and the rightness of their various obsessions. And in that way, get as much of the public as possible to comply voluntarily because this is the only worldview they've ever been exposed to. And they've been told that this is how a bill becomes a law, and this is how the common good is expressed through our democratic institution. And so they don't think any other way. They just, okay, well, I guess Hillary Clinton and Mitt Romney are just teaming up to make my life better.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. And also, I would say that when it comes to the technocracy and the sort of digital component, which again, we've seen such a huge surge in the era of COVID-19, that I often find, and this is a combination of the state schooling that you're mentioning, and then maybe just general propaganda, or I don't know where it comes from exactly, but this idea that I think has been seeded into the minds of many of us, but especially the younger generations, that this digital landscape is all but inevitable. And I'm not a Luddite trying to abolish computers or anything like that, but I do think that, and what my book calls for, especially the update, is for us to really evaluate the relationship that we choose to have with technology, digital technology, because for the most part, it is a voluntary relationship. We choose whether or not we want to be on Twitter or if we want to get a Neuralink implant in our brain or whatever we want to do. Now, obviously, it's different when it comes from governmental tools. And we saw that with COVID passports and things. But on a very grand scale, we choose how we interact with this technology. And I'm essentially calling for all of us, especially libertarians, to start rethinking and reevaluating how we are going to have a relationship with these technologies, which seem, from my perspective, many of them to be inherently anti-liberty and anti-privacy.
Well, let me ask you an abstract question about technology. I know a lot of libertarians, maybe more like 10 years ago as compared to today, were convinced that technology would be our way out of slavery to the state. That was the way they would think about it. And then we've seen more and more clearly how technology can be used for the opposite purpose. Mm-hmm. So I guess my question to you is, what overall, on net, would you say about technology in terms of whether it's on balance a good or a bad for the cause of liberty?
Yeah, and I'll say this, Tom, I was one of those libertarians 10 years ago who had that more optimistic view. I think I picked it up from people like Adam Kokesh and others who were very, very optimistic in the early 2010s when I was just getting my start. And I started getting paid in Bitcoin and using crypto back in 2011, 2012. So I was very much like, this is the revolution. Like, we're going to eliminate central banks and it's going to be amazing. And I think there's still some little bit of hope of that with crypto specifically, but maybe digital technology. But I am obviously a lot less optimistic these days. I don't know that there's any perfect libertarian position per se, right? When it comes to technology, I do think that's very much an individual decision. But I've come to the understanding in more recent years that we seem to be in a digital arms race of sorts, where whether it's private companies or governments, DARPA, organizations like that within the US government and elsewhere, who are building the next stage of artificial intelligence and quantum computing and all this kind of potentially really amazing and potentially really scary stuff, that we just have this back and forth. The state or the technocratic state or even the private companies might create some tools that could be very dangerous to individuals' privacy and liberty. And then you might have on the other side, you've got the so-called white hat hackers trying to figure out how to have better encryption to compete with that new invasion of privacy. And I feel like that's just where we're at now. I'm grateful enough to know people like my buddy Ramiro Romani, who runs TakeBackOurTech.org, and he's been helping get people off big tech phones and trying to take a practical approach. And that's what I mean, is like, there's people like him trying to say, hey, let's use these tools, but try to use them better, smarter, more privacy oriented. And then there's the other side, which is constantly trying to get further into our lives and peer more into our lives. And that could just be for things like selling you better ads, or it could be for spying on your personal habits, things like that. But I tend to feel like, yeah, we're in the middle of a ongoing digital arms race.
That's an interesting way to put it. I think that's exactly right. And I was pretty optimistic too. I was even optimistic because, you know, if you recall back in, let's say, 2010, we never heard anything about somebody's YouTube video being removed. I mean, it's hard to imagine that today. And we have to remind ourselves that nobody was talking about that. Nobody thought, well, I better not mention this topic because it's too hot and YouTube will take it down. We didn't think that way at all. I mean, the craziest people in the world could put a video up and we just figured, well, everybody will understand that some people are crazy and they have crazy videos and so what? You know, it's okay. The governments of the world release crazy videos 24 hours a day. We all learn to live with it. So yeah, I had a fairly optimistic view of this. And now I feel like I have to have a more guarded, reasonable, less Pollyanna type view. But I still feel like there's still tremendous potential here. The very fact that you and I can have this conversation, and in principle, anyone around the world can listen to it, sure, still puts us way ahead of where we used to be. But absolutely, we have to, as we've seen, we have to be reasonable about it. Let's talk about COVID and what lessons we need to take away from these few years from a technological point of view.
Sure. This was the major reason that I chose to write the book, update the book, is because of COVID-19. And as you mentioned, like, I didn't know that the things I was writing about, I mean, I could sort of read the tea leaves a little bit and say, okay, this is the direction we're going in. There are people much educated and informed these areas than myself. I'm just going to put together the book and kind of a warning and a call to action. And then, you know, about a month after I wrote the book, we start hearing the word COVID-19. We go into lockdown and here we are nearly 3 years later. Needless to say, there's been a lot learned in that time. And I feel like I've learned a lot of personal individual lessons that I tried to put into this work. but also through my work with the Freedom Cell Network, and those who've heard you talk with John Bush will be familiar with the Freedom Cell Network. We have people who are part of this loose, decentralized network from all around the world, many of whom tried to get out of their country from Europe, Austria, Australia, Germany, some really strict places to come to maybe the United States and go be in Texas or Florida, or they came to Mexico where I live because Mexico is one of only five countries that didn't lock down or have restrictions or quarantines or anything like that. So I've gained a lot of, I think, data from the community sort of crowdsourcing of, well, how did you avoid this? Or what did you have to deal with when you were trying to get out of your country? And what did this look like? And I wanted to be able to put that information into as practically as possible. And so for the new section of the book, which I just called Exit and Build to Overcome the Great Reset, I think most of the audience here will be familiar with the term Great Reset. Yep. I started out with just the term COVID-1984 as the chapter, which was kind of, that chapter itself is more of just a recap of like, hey, in case you missed the last 3 years, here's all the insanity that we witnessed from, like you mentioned, the censoring, but to people being locked in their homes, people being fired, and all the glorious things we witnessed the last 3 years. And also, I will say, Tom, I'm kind of writing this with a little bit of an aim towards history. I have sort of this book in mind that if I'm going to find this in 5 to 10 years, and they didn't necessarily live through COVID-19, or maybe in the coming years, which I think is going to happen with the benefit of hindsight, people will start to be like, wow, that was a really crazy thing. I can't believe I didn't see it at the time. And I want there to be like, this is a record of what we lived through and some of the things people had to go through just to see their families, just to keep thinking. And then again, the lessons learned. So I start out with that, just looking at COVID. I mean, because you mentioned like censorship, but without rattling off every example that I put in this book, and some of these, I'm not talking about China. I think people like, yeah, of course, China's crazy. No, I'm talking about in the United States of America, people were given ankle monitors and they were confined to their homes. This is the one example I'm thinking of specifically was in Arkansas, and I'm sure there were others, but a gentleman who was found to be allegedly positive from a PCR test and was told to quarantine. He didn't want to quarantine and he went back to his house. They showed up with the sheriffs and they forced put an ankle monitor on him to make sure that he would quarantine for 2 weeks. That happened in the United States of America. Checking people's license plates as they were leaving one place or another to see if they were coming from the hot zones or whatever they were calling them at the time. All these different kinds of things. You know, we have the digital level, but we also have the very real world aspect that people were being fired, people's income was being threatened in multiple ways. The censorship, obviously, that extends to, for example, people like yourself and others, and myself included, who put out content and try to make a reasonable living doing so. People being demonetized or censored on PayPal and everywhere else because of alleged disinformation. We had involuntary quarantine centers and camps. We had children in plastic bubbles and containers at schools and daycare centers. We had businesses being raided for not closing down and arrests of people for violating lockdowns. We had roving police searching for people not in proper places. Some countries had thermal drones going around checking people's temperatures from the skies, or in China yelling, hey, get back in your house, you're violating lockdown. And obviously the aforementioned mandates for travel, work, and school. I mean, this is what we have lived through. And it was a technocrat's wet dream. I mean, this was just like, if somebody wanted to use technology to advance their agendas, COVID gave them every opportunity they need to not let this crisis go to waste. And so one example, there was actually a reasonable investigation by Wired Magazine in 2021, I believe, that found that more than 300 schools in the United States had installed facial recognition technology under the guise of fighting COVID during 2020. Now, of course, none of that technology has been taken away now that we've sort of moved forward. It's all there now, scanning the faces of these kids, being used for who knows what. And that's kind of what I mean, is like this situation was taken advantage of by private individuals, private organizations, governments to make profit, to advance what I would say a tyrannical agenda. And wanted to make sure that we put that COVID-1984 in a clear understanding for those who maybe missed it or anybody in the future who might find this and who didn't live through it.
Well, I feel kind of the same way in that, of course, I've written quite a bit about this, particularly in my newsletter, but I was just saying the other day to somebody that I did so many podcast episodes on it, and I try to do a lot of my episodes not focus so much on the fleeting issues of the moment, but on more evergreen topics that somebody could listen to 5 years down the road, still get something out of it. And so I look back on all these COVID episodes, and I think, nobody's going to want to go through those. But honestly, I can see a role that they play, which is that in a way, those episodes kind of chronicle the week by week, month by month events that were happening, the specific things they were doing, the arguments they were trying to make, the traps they were laying for us. And to watch that unfold, I think that is also useful. So that was not a waste of time.
Not at all. I think that's work, Tom, because I feel the same way. I have some articles and videos and stuff. I've done dozens of them at this point, and maybe not every single one of them will be evergreen, which is also what I try to aim for, more long-term useful content. But I do think in terms of just documenting the crimes as they are happening, the work you have and others have is going to be extremely valuable.
Yeah, for anybody in the future who, as you say, you know, may not have lived through it or may not have been fully awake, let's say, during it, they may be curious. And it's good for there to be something out there other than Anthony Fauci saved America. Like, that cannot possibly be allowed to become the conventional wisdom. Now, you have, I like your use of the term predator class. I have to start using that. That's a great term. On page 74 of your book, you say, the predator class would love to have a population that is, and then you have five bullet points, isolated and depressed, indoctrinated through public quote-unquote education, dependent on the coming central bank digital currencies, dependent on big agriculture and factory farms, and mindlessly consuming digital technology that mines them for data and monitors their every move. Well, that's not what we learned on Schoolhouse Rock about the people who run the country, exactly. But I can't see anything to disagree with there. So those are pretty big, big areas of life right there. So it's a pretty big task ahead of us to somehow try to fight against that. So where do we even start?
Thank you for highlighting that part. I think that's important. This is a big task here. And the reason I pointed to those areas is because as I was studying and listening to various stories I heard in my own experience, it's like, where were the main attack vectors, as I call them in the book, that we saw? One, locking people down, which is the isolation, the depression. We saw spikes in suicides and mental illness and drinking, alcoholism, I mean, all kinds of horrible things because of the forced isolation, forcing people not to be able to work or go to school. And then the public education, your audience is clearly familiar with why this is dangerous, but I think this is becoming more and more clear. And then now everybody is learning about this term CBDCs, central bank digital currencies. We're seeing PayPal and Cash App and the various payment platforms having to bow to the IRS and start reporting people for transactions of $600 or more. We see places like the Netherlands and some places in Europe where what is coming from the United Nations Agenda 2030 and the net zero agenda, where they're starting to go after farms claiming that they're carbon polluters or they're putting out too much nitrogen, and they're going to buy them back and then take them forcibly if they have to buy people out of their farms. And then the final one, of course, is just being sucked into this beautiful but very chaotic world of digital technology that kind of live halfway in. And as I mentioned earlier, there's pros and cons to that. But these five areas, I feel like big tech, food, money, the education, and then through the education is the kids, and then just kind of mental health, if you will. Those areas, I feel like, whether purposeful or not, they're clear to me that these are areas that we are under attack. And I believe will continue to be in the coming years because, as I mentioned, they're part of the Agenda 2030 of the United Nations, their net zero agenda, which is not going anywhere. We're 2022 right now, about to go into 2023. I've been trying to remind people in my talks as I've been touring the US and Mexico the last year that we need to think in terms of that. These people, let's say the United Nations, World Economic Forum, their various cohorts, they work night and day on their agendas. They're spending trillions of dollars. They clearly are invested in this agenda and bringing it forth, if not exactly in 2030, somewhere close to there. That's their aim, right? And so you ask, where do we start? I think that what's important for each person hearing this is to take kind of a self-assessment or maybe a family assessment or a community assessment, if you will, looking at your own family situation and perhaps trying to understand, okay, when it comes to education, are my kids in the indoctrination centers or are they taking Tom Wood's homeschooling curriculum? Is all my money invested in the bank, tied up in there, or do I have any money in silver, gold, crypto, or whatever type of other alternative investments you might feel comfortable in? Or at the very least, thinking about what am I going to do when this inevitable announcement that we're switching to CBDCs, because every single nation in the world is now working or talking about a timetable of 2024, 2025 to start rolling out CBDCs, and could be even sooner now that people are feeling really inspired to regulate the crypto space after this FTX stuff. You could look at food. So I'm not necessarily saying everybody needs to be a farmer or should want to be a farmer per se, but I do think we can all understand the value in developing relationships with people who are growing food outside of our local supermarket. The same supermarkets that by and large required us to wear masks or required us to show proof of shop, you know, a thing like that in order to shop. And so again, what I'm asking people is like, if you're living in an area during the last 2.5-3 years where you were locked down and the local businesses wouldn't let you go in anywhere without showing proof of shots and all that kind of stuff, then if you don't have the ability to leave or to move, which, you know, voting with your feet is always a good option. If you don't have that option though, then you need to start thinking, well, what can I actually practically do? What can I do for my family? If moving isn't an option, or if I'm committed to the town or the city I live in, okay, well, maybe just start with these five focal areas: the kids, the education, the food, the finances, community. Do you have a strong local church community or activist community through the Freedom Cell Network? Just strong family that kind of has a good family unit that you feel like you're not going to be suffering under forced isolation, things like that. Because these updates are not only let's remember what happened during COVID time, but they're also a warning about the potential, which I think is a very real potential, for either the next quote unquote pandemic that Bill Gates and others have been talking about for a while now, or under the proposed climate lockdowns, which we're seeing more and more conversation around this idea that, well, when everybody was locked in their homes and nobody was flying and driving, it was so much better for the environment and climate change and these kinds of things. So maybe we should have periodic lockdowns for people just because of the climate. Oh, if it gets too high on our climate meter, we say, hey, everybody stay in for 72 hours, or only houses ending in odd numbers get to drive today. I mean, these have been crazy to some people, but all of these are proposals that have been put forth by various people, and not just random people on Twitter, but people with real power and real influence are already proposing climate lockdowns and are proposing these sorts of things in the future. And so I don't think we've seen the end of this by any means. And so just starting point, I would say, look at those five focal areas that you brought up, Tom, and just game plan, you know, like kind of have a, just like they like to have their event 201 and game plan how they would handle a theoretical coronavirus outbreak. Maybe you and your family and your community can game plan, well, what would we do if there was another lockdown? What would we do if they said we can't go to work anymore because of the climate or the next pandemic or whatever? I can't give you those perfect answers. I put a lot of suggestions and things in here to try to avoid some of these restrictions, but ultimately it's going to be up to each individual to say, what level of freedom are you after and what are you willing to do to maintain that?
Hey folks, quick sponsor message. If you're like me with Christmas here, you're sending gifts all over the country. And I'll tell you something, your friends already have the gift basket with the sausage stick and the cheese. They've already got that. What they don't have is a massive variety bundle from Omaha Steaks. Omaha Steaks have been a staple of the Woods household since probably 2008. Great value, convenient, and delicious. Well, they are having a massive blowout right now that's made even better because you know Tom Woods. They put together a delicious selection of various gift packages to make shopping for the ones you love nice and easy. Go to omahasteaks.com, take advantage of 50% off site-wide, plus use code WOODS at checkout to get an additional $40 off your order. So send an assortment of mouth-watering favorites like the delicious Butcher's Cut Filet Mignon, air-chilled boneless chicken, ultra-juicy burgers, even easy-to-prepare comfort meals that are ready in a flash. And yes, if you give this kind of gift at Christmas, that makes you, let's be honest, a better person than everybody else. So don't wait. Order today and beat the shipping rush. Go to omahasteaks.com and use promo code WOODS at checkout. That's 50% off site-wide. And plus, with promo code WOODS at checkout at omahasteaks.com, get that extra $40 off your order. Minimum order may be required. Let me be very blunt. I'm not telling you anything you don't already know, but some of the suggestions you offer in the book will seem startling to almost everyone reading it.
Sure.
What you're asking of them. So maybe talk about that and maybe try to explain why it's not as unreasonable, let's say, as it might appear.
So I definitely try to, especially with these updates, I mean, Tom, I'm a big believer in spontaneous order, and I still am, but I'll tell you what, I sure have learned over the last few years from the freedom, liberty movement that there are a lot of people who want a step-by-step guide on what they should do. And I don't really see myself as somebody who kind of has the ego to think I've got all the steps figured out or anything like that. And I think, again, we all have subjective preferences, and so it's going to be different. But generally speaking, people are looking for some sort of practical guide. And I really tried to bring that into this one. I talk about protecting your kids and obviously thinking about homeschooling, unschooling, all the different opportunities. I go into what it might take to become unbanked if somebody wanted to choose to do that, to try to avoid the CBDC future. This is something that I currently do. But again, I know that that's not going to be maybe appealing or it might be intimidating for a large swath of the population. And I understand that. So I do try to go from some of the more quote unquote extreme end of saying, hey, if you don't want to be tracked, stop using social media, get rid of your bank account, get rid of your credit card. You know, these are things that I'm not even doing personally. Who knows future, but just to kind of give people, a scope of here's the extreme end. If you really, really don't want to be monitored, or if you're worried about all this stuff, then here's some steps you should take. You know, stop doing this, stop doing this. But now for the rest of you who probably aren't going to go that far, or maybe aren't ready to, right? Because these things, I don't think happen from being totally ingrained into the system to then starting to unplug overnight. I think it is a process. It is a step-by-step thing that happens. So for example, in the section where I talk about becoming unbanked, or even maybe switching to a local credit union, or just starting to think of alternative ways of holding your money that don't necessarily involve trusting these institutions to keep your money there forever, or trusting that once it goes digital, that they won't have some sort of COVID-19 vaccine requirement to get your money back or something like that, right? I mean, these are all, I think, very realistic potentials. So I give ideas like you need to set a deadline, become unbanked as a group. Don't do this alone. If you're trying to do this with your Freedom Cell, your family, with a friend or something, that makes it a lot easier, I think, to kind of go through that process. Take an assessment. Look at your life and your finances and how intertwined are you currently with the banks? Like, do you have direct deposit? Do you have, you got a 401k? You got different things in different places. If you're trying to untangle that, that's going to take time. It's going to take effort. And it could indeed involve a lifestyle change. I think a lot of this will. I don't know that there are going to be any particularly easy get out of jail free card for what we're facing at the moment. I do think fundamentally it will require us to change our habits in different ways. But again, that's going to be up to the individual to decide how far they want to go with that, right? That could be as basic as saying, you know what, I'm using a Google phone or an iPhone. I'd like to switch over and buy one of these privacy phones. That'll be a step in that direction, right? And then I'm going to move my money out of the bank into the credit union for a little while and see how that's going on while I'm also studying gold and silver and crypto, or seeing whatever other options are available to me. Some people, it's kind of a joke I tell every now and then, but to some people, keeping their money stuffed under the mattress or in a safe at home does feel safer to them than keeping it in the banks, right? And that might not be for everyone, but I do think that for some folks that will apply. And then the other thing I've mentioned a few different points is to start thinking in terms of half steps or intermediaries. And I don't mean like just, again, you can't do this overnight. This is going to take a process. So for example, if you are still dealing with a bank account or a credit union, or you have a bank account, you want to start switching to a credit union, you start switching your accounts from the bank to the credit union. The credit unions tend to be a little bit more local. I'm not saying they're perfect or that they don't have any of the same problems or that they won't go to CBDCs in the long term. But I feel like that's a step to get away from some of the criminal banks. I try to offer tips like that for all these areas. I get into food, I get into unbanking, decentralizing the food production systems, because fundamentally what myself and what the Freedom Cell Network and John Bush and with our event, The Greater Reset, which you are speaking at next month, really trying to do is try to build an alternative, a parallel network, a parallel system, maybe eventually a parallel society to this World Economic Forum, United Nations Agenda 2030, Great Reset Vision. Like, they have their vision of 2030. We're calling on the people within our movements to really start thinking about what we want for 2030 and beyond. Because if we choose to just kind of be passive or just keep pointing at like, oh, look at all the crazy things they're doing, but not actually taking any steps to get out of their systems or to build new ones, then I believe we're going to be sucked into them, whether wittingly or unwittingly, because there just won't be another option. So we're really trying to lay the groundwork here and a call to action for people to get out of these systems, to try to create alternative systems where possible. And one other final point I'll make, Tom, is that this whole book is inspired by the work of Samuel Konkin III and his philosophy of agorism and counter economics. And as I say in the book in a few different places, I believe that COVID-19 and everything we faced over the last couple of years further proved Konkin's theories, because as he proposes in the New Libertarian Manifesto, that he saw that this insight, which I think is still just amazing to really recognize, that people will always try to get away from invasive government, whatever their political philosophy is. If there's an aggressive act on them in public lives, maybe not everybody, but most people will try to find a way to avoid that, right? Maybe that's like you're trying to avoid paying a little extra tax on your income tax every year, right? So you move money around, you play different games. Konkin could see that this was something that repeated itself in history. For example, when the communist regime in Russia before the fall of the Soviet Union, he saw that towards the end that there was a huge counter economy. The black market and gray market were massive. Even people in positions of power were buying goods outside of the state's market. And he was predicting that as this progresses and as the state continues to grow and become more aggressive and more invasive in people's lives, that we would start to see a flood of people wanting to get out of those systems and looking for new alternative ways of living. And so when he was writing his books in the 60s and 70s and 80s, he was calling for people who were thinking in a similar way to basically start laying the foundation. Let's start building the counter institutions, the alternative economy, alternative schools, et cetera, et cetera. And now we're at a point where we can see, because of COVID-19, all of a sudden you had everyday regular people considering getting a fake PCR test so they could continue to work or they could go see their family, or people buying fake vaccine cards on the gray market or through the internet so that they could travel to see their family, or again, people who maybe don't want to support that system, but they're like, hey, I got to work somehow and I'm not getting the jab, so I'm going to buy this thing. That's total agorism. That's economics right there. That's people getting away from the state, choosing an alternative. And to me, it really, just the last couple of years, proved out a lot of his theories. And so, yeah, I just wanted to make that clear that much of what I'm promoting is based off what he put forward before, and trying to make note that I think we're seeing it play out right now.
One last thing. Of course, I have had John Bush on the show and I like him a lot and I like to work with him, but I think it's quite likely most people won't know what the Freedom Cell Network is that you referred to a number of times. Can you just say a little something about it?
Sure, absolutely. So the website is freedomcells.org, as in C-E-L-L-S, like the cells in your body. I first heard John Bush, Texas activist, promote it in 2015, and I was really just kind of struck by the idea of organizing and local small groups trying to build a decentralized network for finding community, for maybe homeschooling, unschooling, for growing food, for just building community in general. That's where the idea had been for years prior to COVID. Then when COVID happened in March 2020, our website and just, I guess, the concept and the movement in general really had an exponential growth. We went from a couple thousand people on the website to more than 34,000 people around the world now. And I kind of catalog some of that in this book as well, recapping all the growth that we've experienced in the last couple of years. Because again, in the first edition of this book, I was talking about the Freedom Cell Network as an idea. I was talking about in the future, maybe the state's going to get so strong and we're going to need to have different ways of trading goods or building communities and building outside the system. And the Freedom Cell Network is very much a part of that. So if people are not familiar, I do encourage you to listen to John's interview with Tom about Freedom Cells. And you can always go to freedomcells.org. We've got a nice little intro video. You can learn about it. You can read all about the principles behind the network. But at the base of it, it's a website that operates similar to a social network with the main focus of people joining for free. They create a profile. They say, okay, I live in Houston, Texas. I'm interested in gold trading and learning how to grow my own food or something like that. They add their location to the map, not their home address, but say just the city of Houston or their part of town. And then they can use the maps to search to find other people near them or to search to find other groups near them. And the goal of those is to meet people through the website and then to start meeting in the real world. So we don't intend or want it to be just another place online where people just kind of have the same old conversation. But instead, if you're tired of just talking and you're actively looking for locals in your area that you want to just not feel alone, maybe you want to start thinking about homeschooling, you want to start talking about growing food or getting plugged into the farmers markets or whatever solutions you're focused on, Freedom Cells is a great way to do that. And so much of the information that I did put in this book came from people that I talked to who told me that when COVID happened, they were isolated, were alone, they couldn't work, and they used the Freedom Cell Network website to find people in their local area to start building communities. Some of these people started homeschooling their kids together. Some of them bought land together. Some of them are just maybe more of a social circle, which also I think is important because people would like us to feel alone and isolated. So that's the bulk of the Freedom Cell Network. And if you check out the book, you'll read more about it.
And the book indeed is How to Opt Out of the Technocratic State, second edition. We were talking beforehand about the best way for people to get the book. Why don't you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, absolutely. So as of today, December 12th, I have officially released the book into the world. So if you go to theconsciousresistance.com/how-to, there's a description. You can find all about the book and it's got the table of contents. But you'll see right now there's an E2C PDF download link. So I'm putting the PDF available for free. You can check it out there and get it first. Within, probably by the time you're hearing this, it should be on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the usual online retailers. If not, just check that website, theconsciousresistance.com/how-to. As soon as they go live on there, I'll be putting all the links for all those places. But you can already find the first edition on Amazon and all those other places. The second edition is just going to take maybe another day or so to get up there. And if you don't mind, Tom, I'd like to mention one other final thing from the new stuff.
Yeah, please do.
So one of the things, the final chapter, the new edition is called Agora 2030 and the Agora's Development Goals. And as I mentioned, the United Nations, they have, people are probably familiar with Sustainable Development Goals. If not, long story short, the United Nations and some of these folks behind them have been promoting climate change as the biggest threat to humanity since the early 90s, starting with the Rio Conference, the Rio Summit in 1992. That led to what was known as the Millennial Development Goals, and then the Agenda 21, and then eventually became known as Agenda 2030. And as part of that, the United Nations has put forward what they call Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs. And these are 17 SDGs, including, like, so the first one is, I don't remember them in exact order, but one of them is all people should have digital IDs, because they promote digital IDs as, like, this is the way to help those poor, unbanked people in developing countries that don't have bank accounts and digital IDs. Basically, these people who aren't cataloged by governments yet, they said, well, digital ID is a human right now. So now we need to make sure that they all have access to digital IDs, right? So that's one of the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. And as I mentioned, they're extremely organized. So they have targets. Okay, let's set this target that we're going to aim for to make sure we achieve this goal by 2030. They have markers. You can mark, okay, we did this. We held this event and advanced the goal in this way. And basically, me and John and the Freedom Cell Network and the Greater Reset, which is our mirror event of the World Economic Forum's annual gathering, we're always trying to think of what are the positive things or the effective tactics, let's say, that the other side is using, and how can we repackage those in the name of liberty, in the name of building a better world and trying to maintain individual liberty and privacy. And so, again, the United Nations is extremely, extremely organized. They did a great job with the SDGs. They got a fancy website that's nice and colorful and appealing. And so I started thinking, if we're going to be talking about being just as organized and trying to have a focus for the coming years as this technocratic state is coming into view, then perhaps we need our own version of SDGs. But of course, the difference would be that these goals would be focused on, for one, voluntarism. So it's not like myself or the Freedom Cell Network, we have any power over what people do, right? So we're not like governments making fiat proclamations saying, this is what we're going to do. Instead, the idea would be to have goals that could be completely voluntary and consensual, and that individuals, organizations, businesses, who knows, maybe even eventually governments could voluntarily sign on, in as opposed to supporting the United Nations SDGs. So I propose that a set of what I call Agora's development goals, or maybe a little bit more broad, autonomous development goals is another name I use because I know agorism and agorist is kind of niche. But the idea would be that these autonomous development goals could be adhered to on a voluntary basis by individuals, businesses, civil society organizations who align with this goal and philosophy. And in the book, I sort of outline what I hope is the beginning of them. I'm definitely not trying to say this is what this idea needs to be carved in stone or anything. It's more like putting it out into the ether to the other liberty-minded activists and thinkers and saying, well, let's co-create our own version of goals that our community can aspire to. So, for example, one of the first ADGs that I proposed was to promote access to non-state funded forms of education, that is voluntarism, self-ownership, mutual aid, critical thinking, creativity, and self-directed learning. Goal two, to foster the creation of a network of homeschooling co-ops, unschooling pods, whose services can be easily accessed by parents in need. And you can kind of see, like, we're taking very similar goals that they take, but instead of coming from the top-down, centralized, central planning perspective, we're saying, okay, well, what can we do as just regular people, voluntarily, and what we promote, and then also try to live by and encourage others to aspire to, right? And so I start with just 10 basic ADGs and introduce the idea. And I really do hope anybody hearing this who has an interest in this will check out the book, check out the ADGs I put forward, propose your own. The vision we have, and I don't know if it's going to take a couple more months, we might have it by the Greater Reset next month, but our vision is, just like the United Nations has their website for the SDGs, that we have a website for the ADGs that just lists the goal as succinctly as possible. We're trying to propose an alternative to the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. These are voluntary, consensual. If you would like to sign on board and say, hey, my organization, my group supports this, we're going to aspire to these. In the same way the United Nations does, you see different businesses promote the SDGs and saying, we're trying to fight climate change by supporting the SDGs. I think competition is our key path to victory at this point, is that we can't just sit by and let these people force their agendas down our throats. I don't really have much faith in political solutions, and I definitely don't think violence is the answer, and I don't think apathy is the answer. So to me, agorism, counter-economics, building alternatives, exit and build. Like, these are the solutions that I see as being the real ones that are going to get us through 2030 and beyond.
Well, again, it's a topic that maybe we didn't fully appreciate the significance of in previous years, but as we've watched history unfold, it's become all too obvious to us that we have to confront rather a different situation than we thought. I still, as you say, and as I think we both recognize, there is still tremendous potential for good in technology and the sort of digital things that we do. But we were naive, I think, perhaps, not to fully appreciate how the bad guys could get hold of it and pervert it. And I think also, I think another thing, and maybe we should try to wrap up on this, but I think maybe, and I hate to be a downer, but I think maybe I had too optimistic a view of mankind. Maybe I thought that once the world has access to the kind of information that's been kept from them, they're going to find it, at least a lot of them, and things are going to change. And apparently that wasn't the problem. The problem was not that they didn't have access to the information. Now they do, and for some reason they just don't want it, or they're too lazy or morally corrupt or whatever. I mean, I know people will say to me, I should come up with more charitable explanations for people's inaction. But after 3 years of having the average person repeat all kinds of ridiculous nonsense about why I shouldn't live my life, I guess my patience with them is wearing a little thin.
No, I understand that. And I think you're right. Like, that optimism, it comes from something I've seen in the libertarian movement over the years that I've been involved, which is an inherent desire to bring out the best in humanity and the belief that we are capable of ruling our own lives and taking care of ourselves. And I haven't given up on that per se, but my view is a little bit more tempered now, let's say, with there is still so much positive. I do see positive. I'm definitely not here to say that this is all doom and gloom. In fact, I take solace and excitement from seeing, just as one example, the fact that in this book that I put out in 2020, I talk about the idea of exiting and building, which is like my take on agorism. And now John has launched the Exit and Build Land Summit. I see people in conversation talking about, let's stop focusing on the problems. Let's exit and build. And that's what gives me hope. Seeing that there are people who recognize, like, okay, we're dealing with some pretty tough circumstances and I need to take responsibility for my own life, my family's life, my community. And I need to figure out what I'm going to do in the coming years. And so there is some concern, but I do feel hope. And the final thing I'll say, Tom, I mentioned it briefly, but the fact that we are able to put on an event like the Greater Reset, anybody who's interested, the website's thegreaterreset.org. John is organizing the event live in Texas. I'm organizing the event live in Mexico. We're expecting 400 to 500 plus people in both locations, thousands of people watching online. And the entire event, like yourself, is speakers who are focused on solutions. So you're going to be speaking on our agorism and parallel network today. We're going to be talking all about alternatives, whether it's homeschooling, whether it's getting out of the financial system. But every day of our event is packed with people just like us who do have hope and optimism for the future, but it's not coming from putting faith in politicians or things like that. It's coming from recognizing that the tools, the answers, I mean, I don't know that we have every perfect answer, but I do believe that they are within us, within our communities, and the ingenuity of humanity can come up with a workaround for what we're facing. And so I do take great pride to be involved in this movement, that not only just the libertarian movement, but I hope libertarians who are hearing this are ready to just stop, maybe spend some less time on the philosophical debates in our inner circles and look at the bigger picture. I think the world needs a libertarian message. It needs the agorist message. And to me, the way to do that is to try to reach the mass and help them see. You know, even though I don't necessarily use the word libertarian, I don't even think I use it one time in my book. The ideas that are progen there are libertarian values of volunteerism. There's no status solutions in there. There's no begging the masters to just come save us. It's all about being proactive and recognizing the inherent individual liberty and potential within everybody and saying, look, we can create a better future. So I'm trying to do that with the Greater Reset, with the Freedom Cell Network, and with this new book. And I appreciate the time to talk to your audience about it, Tom.
Well, thank you, Derek. Again, tomwoods.com/2254. I'll have how you can pick up the book. Again, it's How to Opt Out of the Technocratic State by our guest, Derek Bros. Thanks again, Derek.
Thank you.
All right, folks, that is another episode of the Tom Woods Show. I will see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.